Mr. President, members of the Reserve Officers Association of the United States, ladies and gentlemen, it's a very, very great pleasure for me to be with you again this evening. I've been here on several occasions, and I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to be here as a private citizen. Retired colonel, if you please. I appreciated that band music by the Navy Band very, very much. And I also appreciated receiving dinner ticket number one, and if the hotel is short one ticket, I've got it, and I'm going to keep it. The reception tonight before the dinner was wonderful. I met a large number of people that I've known for a long, long time, and I was more than happy to see that they're still interested in the welfare of this country by being active in this organization. When I received that Hawaiian lei a while ago, I thought I was back in Honolulu, where I had a grand vacation. And since I'm a sort of a charter member of this organization, I feel right at home. As you know, I helped to organize the first association of reserve officers at Kansas City, Missouri, back in 1922, and that was where unification started. That organization was made up of Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force. In the past, we have agreed with one another on some of the basic issues before the country, and I think we still agree on them. During the 5 months that have passed since I left the White House, I've done some real work and also a great deal of just plain resting and thinking. It has been a treat for me to be able to read the papers without having to make plans for handling the problems that appear in the headlines. Someone else has the job of worrying about them now. Whenever responsibility for the government of the United States has passed from one party to another in our history, there has been a measure of change and a measure of continuity. From my vantage point in Missouri, it has been extremely interesting, at times downright fascinating, to watch the new administration review the policies of the old administration and to observe where changes occur and where there has been continuity. In the stated objectives of our foreign policy, I think it is fair to say that there has been more continuity than there has been change. That is as it should be. A foreign policy, by its very nature, needs to be a continuing policy. And if it is to continue, it has to be a national policy, not a party policy. During my term of office, we did succeed in maintaining a truly national bipartisan foreign policy. Although there was always one wing of the Republican Party that was bent on obstructing and wrecking our foreign policy objectives, there were enough Republicans who joined with us to make possible our great national undertaking. Our work in the United Nations, our program for the revival of Europe, our efforts to rally, strengthen, and unite the whole free world against communism, all these were national programs with the support by almost all Democrats and by a substantial segment of the Republican Party. When the United States took the lead in defending the Republic of Korea against brutal aggression, we had bipartisan support, wholehearted bipartisan support. That's exactly what I mean. I've been glad to observe that the elections last fall have not changed the attitude of the Democratic Party toward the foreign policy of the United States. The Democratic Party, in the Congress and out, continues to support the United Nations and the unity and defense of the free world. Unfortunately, however, the elections last fall have strengthened the irresponsible element in the Republican Party. The grave burden of national leadership has apparently brought about no change in the attitude of the reckless isolationist wing of that party. As a consequence, whenever a critical issue of our foreign policy comes before the Congress, it is the Democrats whose votes can be counted on to keep this country on the road to peace and freedom. Just last week, our mutual security program came before the House of Representatives for a vote. Effort after effort was made, principally by the Republicans, to slash that program well below the margin of safety. The Republican leadership appealed to the Republican members to support the program of the Republican president. The Republican leaders appealed in vain. Republicans by the score deserted their leaders to vote for the cuts. In fact, I am told a majority of the Republicans voted for the cuts and against their president in the standing votes when their names were not recorded. It was the Democrats under Sam Rayburn, the minority leader, who provided the margin of victory for the Republican administration on these amendments, and I feel highly pleased that they did that. I know that our president has the approval of the Democratic Party for our continuing national policies for peace and freedom. And I'm sure that whenever the president fights for his international policies against the growing forces of isolationism, the Democrats in Congress will certainly back him up and give him their fup, and give him their fup, and give him their fup, and give him their fullest support. As a minority party, we still stand for what we believed in when we were in the majority. My friends, I think that is the way for a responsible opposition party to operate. I believe we are seeing some results from these continuing national policies. I think we will see even greater results if they are firmly pursued by a united country over an even longer period of time. I am happy to tell you that there are signs of tension behind the Iron Curtain. The Soviet policies of aggression are meeting growing difficulties. These developments did not just happen by themselves. Many of them came about directly or indirectly because of things that this nation did last year or the year before or 4 or 5 years ago. Take Berlin, for example. 5 years ago, you remember, the communists blockaded the city of Berlin and tried to starve its brave people into surrender. We came to their support with an unprecedented airlift. The flag of freedom continued to fly over Berlin. Last week, in the sector of Berlin that is still under the heel of the Red Army and throughout the Russian-occupied zone of Germany, we saw a great spontaneous uprising of the German people against their oppressors. We saw that the spirit of freedom was still alive there in spite of the years of repression. But I do not believe that this would ever have been the case if we had pulled out of Berlin in 1948. I do not believe that a thing like this could have happened if we had abandoned the free people of Korea in 1950. Despite the signs that our national policies may be succeeding, there is no reason for anybody to think that our troubles are over. The greatest danger period of this Cold War is not necessarily behind us, as some seem to think. We may be in our greatest danger period right now, or it may be just ahead of us. Nobody on this side of the Iron Curtain knows what is going on in the minds of the men in the Kremlin. But we do know that all around the borders of the Soviet Empire are explosive spots where violence can erupt at any time. From such eruption, a chain of events can always lead to a crisis in which the communists may take some reckless step that will plunge the world into a third world war. Or, as problems and tensions grow behind the Iron Curtain, it is even possible that the tyrants in the Kremlin may deliberately risk everything in a cold and ruthless gamble on the use of force, rather than face the possibility of a weakening of their power. Any weakness on our part will increase these dangers. It would be tragic indeed if our success thus far should lead us to slacken our efforts prematurely. Now, this brings me to the principal topic I wish to talk about tonight. That is our national defense. National defense, like our foreign policy, should be a bipartisan affair. It affects the future of every one of us, no matter what our political beliefs may be. And so I want to talk about our national defense tonight, not as a Democrat, but as a citizen, as one who is concerned deeply with that subject and has had considerable experience with it. Our national defense is a key element in our whole foreign policy. We simply cannot lead the free world and secure a condition of peace if our defenses are weak. Big talk does not impress the rulers of the Soviet Empire. They are champions at big talk and double talk too, and we can't challenge them in that field. What impresses them are planes and divisions and ships. What they watch most carefully is not the speeches we make, but how much effort we are putting into our national defense. They watch our national defense appropriations, and they plan their moves accordingly. 3 years ago, after the communist attack on Korea, we set out on a very intensive effort to build our military forces to the point where we could feel reasonably secure against the naked aims of world conquest that the Soviets displayed. As in matters of foreign policy, we had a very impressive degree of national unity in our rearmament efforts too. Our unity and our determination must in themselves have given the Kremlin pause. Republicans and Democrats joined together in voting the legislation and the appropriation. Many patriotic Republicans, like Bob Levitt and Charlie Wilson of General Electric and Eric Johnson, came into our Democratic administration to help administer the mobilization program. In those days, after the attack on Korea, few men raised any question as to the urgency of the need. Here and in other free lands, to build military forces so strong that the Russians could not dare to attack again. And few men raised any question as to the ability of this country to do what it set out to do. All through 1951 and 1952, the criticism that I received was mainly from the opposite direction. Why weren't we arming faster? Why weren't we doing more? You reserve officers in this audience were, I believe, among the people who asked those questions more often. You knew something about war firsthand. You knew the Russians were arming swiftly. You had no illusions about their intentions. You wanted to be sure that this great nation was keeping pace. Looking back now, I'm glad that you and others asked those questions. You gave us the support we needed to lay out and start a program that was big enough and bold enough to meet the challenge of the times in which we live. During 1951, we went rapidly ahead on military production. The Joint Chiefs of Staff studied the question as to what our military goals for the next few years should be. They emerged with a balanced program which called for an army of 21 divisions, a navy of 400 active ships, and an air force of 143 wings. And they urged that we try to achieve these targets just as soon as possible after 1954, because they believed that it was about that time that they expected the Soviets to have amassed a stockpile of atomic bombs that would put this country in the gravest kind of danger. and there was never any idea, as has been incorrectly stated in some high places, that our post-Korea defense program was designed to build up to a peak in 1954 or at any other particular time. Our plans were to build the defense forces we needed as soon as possible and then to continue those forces at whatever strength was necessary for as long as necessary.